Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Since I was young, I've been intrigued by the work of Upton Sinclair. I remember, as a boy, hearing about Sinclair's books and efforts to change the world. A close friend of my family was the writer for Sinclair's campaign newspaper when he ran for governor of California in 1934. Although that was long before I was born, the stories rolled during our friend's later visits. Sinclair is perhaps best known for his book, The Jungle, published in 1906, which openly revealed the inhumane conditions of the Chicago stockyards and how the meatpacking industry of that time operated, resulting in the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Laws within months after the publication of The Jungle. Radical Innocent, Upton Sinclair, is the name of a biography written by retired professor Anthony Arthur, released in June 2006, 100 years after the publication of The Jungle, and tells the story of Upton Sinclair's life. Arthur weaves the strands of Sinclair's contentious public career in his often troubled private life, which Sinclair at times himself willingly revealed, into a compelling personal narrative. Anthony Arthur rates integrity as Sinclair's greatest strength and claims his eloquence in writing and speech, along with his reputation for selflessness, as the basis for a groundswell of support for Sinclair and his ideas. I spoke with Anthony Arthur at the end of August 2006 from his home near Los Angeles, California. He began by describing what attracted him to study and write about Upton Sinclair.
Well, I think what drew me to him in the first place was that he was acknowledged to be a major figure in American history as well as literature, but very little had been done on him that wasn't kind of by his admirers and disciples. And I came at him rather more objectively as having spent a career teaching American literature. And with this very interesting figure, major figure, kind of on the sidelines. And I was curious as to why that should have been the case.
What did you find to satisfy your curiosity? That's a good question for Radio Curious.
Well, what I found was that he doesn't fit neatly into any categories. And for people to be, I think, put into the canon, either in terms of history or literature, they have to be easily recognizable and easily fittable. And he was anything but. He was very conservative in his personal habits. He never drank, never smoked, despised the notion of free love, which when he was a young man in the early 1900s was very much in the air. Despised indulgence of any kind, was sometimes compared to Savonarola, the fanatical Florentine priest, or Peter the Hermit, or Don Quixote. He had some qualities of a zealot, and some of his enemies even said a fanatic. But there was a kind of innocence about him that I picked up on, along with these radical notions of social change. But as you can see, that doesn't fit into the American perspective as readily as one might have thought.
Well, how would you characterize that misfit or lack of fit?
Well, he grew up kind of straddling two worlds. He was born in 1878 to a family that on the one side had wealth. His mother's sister married into a very wealthy Baltimore family, and he visited his uncle's family frequently throughout the years. But his mother and his father, who was a salesman and a drunk and irresponsible, though amiable, they lived in boarding houses and flop houses in Baltimore and then New York, where he grew up from the age of 10. So he said he always grew up seeing these two worlds that seemed to be irreconcilable. And he saw himself as split in his sensibilities. He grew up scorning the wealthy and the privileged, even though he was, by inheritance, a part of it. And a kind of an aristocrat by sensibility, thought of himself as a Southerner most of his life, always spoke with a slight Southern accent, which surprised a lot of people. But I think he said that those early experiences, growing up, seeing poverty on the one hand and wealth on the other, made him what he was, eventually a socialist.
He was also a very bright man. He graduated the university at age 15.
Yeah, 15, and then went to graduate school at Columbia, where he took courses for a couple of years. He found out that he could take as many courses as he wanted without penalty, without having to pay extra. So he would just go to class and get the syllabus and find out what the key books were and go to a couple of lectures to get the flavor of the thing and then do the rest on his own. He did that especially with learning foreign languages, which he had some facility with.
Your description of the way he learned foreign languages, using the Bible as a base text.
Well, he knew the Bible well because his mother had raised him to, she hoped, become an Episcopalian priest, but he grew away from organized religion very early. But he kept his familiarity with the Bible as, in the King James Version, a grand work of literature, and he knew it pretty well. So by reading, say, German or French versions of the Bible, he could impose on his memory the vocabulary and syntax and so on, especially the vocabulary, just because he knew the originals so well. I've tried that myself, actually, and it works pretty well.
Upton Sinclair's early and perhaps most famous work in writing is The Jungle. Tell us about The Jungle and what you know that drew him to write about the meatpacking industry in 1906.
He was at that time in 1904 when he started the research for the book. He was just 25 years old and regarded himself as a kind of a failed literary artist because he had written several very sensitive novels about failed and suicidal young poets and that kind of thing, which didn't attract a wide audience. And he was quite depressed about his career as a writer. He called himself a penniless rat. And then he stumbled into a meeting with a couple of prominent socialists, one of them Gaylord Wilshire, after whom Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles is named. And these two men turned him on to socialism as a concept, and he was angry because he'd gone through college and part of graduate school without ever learning anything about this. In the summer of 1903, the meatpackers in Chicago were engaged in a long and difficult strike, which they had just finally lost, and he wrote a little plea in a radical newspaper to them not to lose hope. And as a result of that, he was offered a commission to go and to write a book, not necessarily a novel, about the plight of workers, not necessarily meatpackers. He took himself to Chicago in the fall of 1904, stayed for 6 weeks, going through the Armour meatpacking facility. He met Jane Addams, among other people, and met a whole host of people who gave him information. And he recorded it all. Then he went home and wrote this novel about immigrants working in the meatpacking industry.
What did he tell us?
What he was intending to tell us and what he did tell us was how difficult conditions were for the workers in industries like meatpacking. But what was received by his reading audience was the message that their meat was rotten and dangerous. I stress that message sent and message received were a little different, because he said he aimed at the nation's heart and hit it in the stomach by mistake. What he was trying to do was to raise sympathy for the workers and to engender a kind of impatience with the system and to get it changed in the same way that slavery had been changed by Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which raised so much sympathy for the black slaves that chattel slavery, as it was called, was effectively abolished. Abraham Lincoln said that Mrs. Stowe had actually been the cause of the Civil War. And Sinclair wanted to do something similar with the war between labor and capital that he saw.
Well, with the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act after the publishing of The Jungle,
same year,
he had some success.
Yeah. Well, he did indeed. The book came out in February, and the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed in June of 1906.
But he also had the help of Theodore Roosevelt at that time.
Yes, indeed. And Roosevelt actually invited Sinclair to come down to the White House so they could talk about his book and the bill that was then currently going through Congress and had been bottled up by the meatpacking interests. And they did have a meeting in the first week of April, 1906, and some fairly extended interaction for the couple of months after that.
Your book, Radical Innocent, Upton Sinclair, The Extraordinary Story of How the Author of The Jungle Set Out to Change America, is published along with the 100th anniversary of Sinclair's publishing of The Jungle. So you have these books next to each other in unity.
That was my original intent, was to bring the biography out the centenary of The Jungle. I thought it would be a way of drawing the public's interest to Sinclair and obviously to my book.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Professor Emeritus Anthony Arthur, who taught at California State University at Northridge, a suburb of Los Angeles, California, about his book, Radical Innocent, Upton Sinclair, The Extraordinary Story of How the Author of The Jungle Set Out to Change America. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Tony Arthur, would you consider yourself a social activist in comparison to Upton Sinclair?
No, I'm just a humble scribbler. That is, I was a literature professor for my career and not a social activist. I had earlier worked as a newspaper reporter, but I've been an observer rather than a shaker, mover and a shaker in the way that Sinclair was. And that's the way most writers are. Sinclair was unusual in that he was both a writer and an activist, and unusual in the sense that very few activists have been literary artists and novelists to the degree that Sinclair was. And that's what makes him stand out from his contemporaries, or his slightly older contemporaries, like Ida Tarbell and others who were better known for their nonfiction exposés rather than their literary qualities.
Well, let's talk about Upton Sinclair's social activism. You mention how he was awakened to the concept of socialism, and then a number of years later, beginning in 1933, he abandoned socialism, became a Democrat, and became the Democratic nominee for governor of California in the election of 1934. Can you tell us about that work, his efforts, and his political campaign?
Yeah, he had been registered as a socialist for 25 years and had run several times, senator, governor, and so on, never gaining more than a handful of votes, relatively. So he'd become pretty well convinced that socialism as a doctrine was just never going to fly in the United States. But he thought if he got into the Democratic Party, when they approached him to run, because of his name recognition, he was candid about trying to take over the Democratic Party and make it into adopt his socialist platform. So he didn't regard himself as abandoning socialism. He just thought practically that party was never going to amount to anything in this country, and I think he was right. And he also felt that some of FDR's programs after Roosevelt was elected in 1932 were similar to the kinds of things that he was looking for, although they didn't go far enough in his mind. So when he ran for governor, it was as a Democrat a Democrat with a clear kind of socialist platform.
His platform was called EPIC, or End Poverty in California. And you link that back to his childhood observations of poverty. Can you tell us a little bit more about that connection?
Well, Sinclair, all his life, was not a theorist. He was a moralist. His mother wanted him to be a Methodist priest. He never was, but he really was a preacher of a kind of social doctrine. He looked at socialism as what he called the religion of humanity. So he approached political questions from a moral standpoint, some said a moralistic standpoint. So when he looked around and he said, if you take this one basic precept, there's no reason for poverty to exist in a country that's so rich, even in the Depression, still relatively rich, that was simply wrong and that it ought to be changed. So then he, with that principle, he went to look at ways of adapting it in practical terms. And he put together a program that he called End Poverty in California that did such things as take over factories that had gone belly up because they'd failed, and to put workers into those factories, let the state pay them until they could get them going again. Same thing with unused farmland, with the state being the employer of last resort, or in this case, of almost first resort. You know, it was a pretty radical program, and it raised a lot of doubts among people who own property and business owners. And they combined their efforts to make sure that he was defeated. But he had an extraordinary amount of support from not just poor people, which was, I think was the perceived opinion for a long time, but a large number of the middle class and lower middle classes supported Sinclair and his efforts. And he didn't come that far from losing. He got about 39% of the vote in the final election. So it was a pretty respectable showing for such a radical program.
In addition, in part of the EPIC program, he had what I believe he called the Old Age Revolving Pension Plan that employed a sales tax for the benefit of people over 60. How did that work?
Well, that actually wasn't his plan. That was Mr. Townsend's plan, I believe. Now, he came up with a similar one, but it was not based on the sales tax, which he regarded as regressive. So there was a problem there with this retired dentist from Long Beach, Mr. Townsend, who was had a huge number of followers, and Sinclair was a bit undiplomatic with Mr. Townsend. He called him an idiot and estranged Townsend and his, you know, hundreds of thousands of California followers. He had a nationwide following. But that was a problem. Sinclair wanted to guarantee a kind of old age pension, but he didn't want to do it with the same kind of funding that Townsend had advocated, and that confused voters, I think.
Well, how did Sinclair's program work versus a Townsend's program? What were they like?
Well, Sinclair's interest in old age pensions was really a kind of side issue for him. What he was really concerned with was the problem of excessive wastage of goods. He talked about milk being dumped into pits and pigs being slaughtered and their carcasses being thrown into pits. He said that the problem was that there was excessive production, and he had to reconcile consumption with production. And this incredible waste going on was what offended him. And he thought simply that the whole system of capitalism was inherently inefficient and unproductive. And he thought socialism, with public ownership of the means of production, of course, but going even beyond that, almost expropriation of improperly used factories and farmlands. He was much more concerned with that kind of thing than he was with what Mr. Townsend was concerned with, was how to treat retirees.
Taking Upton Sinclair's concept substantially later into the 1960s, he gave what you characterize as a fairly significant presentation at the University of Indiana in Bloomington, a talk called Changing America and What Will Happen If You Try. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was in his 80s. Sinclair, as he said, as he put it, found himself becoming respectable. This was the period, of course, when John F. Kennedy had been recently elected in 1963. And we're talking about the talk that he gave in 1963, well into Kennedy's presidency, and the kind of idealism that a lot of younger people had been feeling made Sinclair a welcome guest on a lot of college campuses. He'd not quite quit writing by that time, because he wrote almost up until he died at 90. He loved to go and talk to young people, and he was very good with them. He always spoke without notes, and he still had it together. He was a compelling kind of physical personage on stage. He wasn't very large. He was only about 5'7", weighed about 140 pounds, had a kind of almost a noble Roman profile, kind of a hawk nose and square chin. Thinning hair, his wire-rimmed glasses. And he had this intensity of moral vision that he'd kept all his life, even though in many ways he was a rather, you know, a self-centered, egotistical man. But he came across as a man, as I said, of extraordinary integrity and intensity and honesty, and I think that audiences responded to that.
So what's the answer to the title in his speech, What Will Happen If You Try to Change America?
Well, he gave the kind of a standard speech at a lot of different campuses, and this was also one that he gave, the one that he gave at Indiana. He had encountered, he said, among others, Philip D. Armour, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and Henry Ford during his life, and he did battle with all three of those. The first one, of course, is best known because of The Jungle. The Rockefeller confrontation came in 1914, having to do with the Ludlow massacre in Colorado. The Colorado Fuel and Iron Company was a subholding of the Rockefeller interests, and Sinclair got involved in activity having to do with combating the Rockefeller interests. And then the third had to do with the UAW strike against the Ford Motor Company in 1937, when Sinclair wrote a novel called The Flivver King, in which he attacked Henry Ford, who he had met much earlier in 1918 or 19, out in Pasadena when Ford was living there for the winter, and they had gotten on rather well. But these three key figures were the three great contenders, the great battles that Sinclair said he had fought during his life. Now, what happened to him as a result of these encounters was that he became famous as a kind of voice for social justice. He was optimistic at the end of his life. He said, this is a country where you can do this kind of thing and you won't get killed. Or at least he didn't. And he said that this is one of the ways in which America is different from most of the countries in the world, where it's not safe to fight these kinds of battles. So it wasn't that what happened to you wasn't entirely negative by any means.
And he also had some success, significant successes along the way.
Yeah, the successes were all qualified, as any kind of battle against such forces would have to be. But he thought that he had fought the good fight. and most people, I think, agreed with him, even when they thought that, you know, maybe he was a bit, over-congratulatory about what he had accomplished. In other words, it was Theodore Roosevelt and a host of other people for working for many years who had brought about the Pure Food and Drug Act. Sinclair came along at the crest of the wave and wrote a novel which dramatized the difficulties and did a lot to help push it through in its final stages. But it didn't happen. The Pure Food and Drug Act didn't happen just because of Sinclair's novel and that kind of thing. But he did accomplish a whole lot more than almost anybody else in American history has accomplished working from his vantage point, which was a man always on the outside. Never had an appointment, for example, as a tenured writer, as a tenured professor of writing at a university. Never had a Rockefeller grant, which would be amusing to think about, or a Ford Foundation grant. He was always an independent man.
Well, Anthony Arthur, author of Radical Innocent, the biography of Upton Sinclair, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, I can. I'm about 90% of the way through T.E. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is, of course, the we all know the movie Lawrence of Arabia. But it was drawn from Lawrence's own account of his adventures with the Arabs during World War I in the deserts of Arabia.
Anthony Arthur, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It's been a pleasure, Barry. Thank you.
Professor Anthony Arthur is the author of Radical Innocent, Upton Sinclair. The book he recommends is Seven Pillars of Wisdom, A Triumph, by T.E. Lawrence. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.